We're talking a variety of school issues this hour, all related to K through 12 institutions. First, a Chicago Tribune investigation reveals failures in CPS to protect hundreds of victims from sexual abuse. We'll hear from reporters David Jackson and Jennifer Smith Richards. Plus, when kids experience traumatic events like violence in their communities, it can also hurt them for the rest of their lives.
We have kids walking around with chronic PTSD. We have kids like repressing the violence that they've seen, the fear that they have of not graduating.
And a school in southwestern Illinois has gotten national attention for the way they teach character. Here's an Ellis Elementary student speaking to the Belleville News Democrat.
My school taught me about character is that be yourself and don't try and be someone else, because if you do that, you'll probably lose a lot of people that you were your friends because you tried to be someone else.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We know most schools are out for the summer, but today we're focusing on all kinds of school issues. We're starting the hour with a Chicago Tribune investigation into sexual abuse and assault within Chicago public schools. Later, we're going to be learning how schools across Illinois are helping students traumatized by violence. And we're ending today's program with Belleville Elementary School. They just received national recognition for a program in helping its students develop character. But first, just a note for our audience that the next 15 minutes, we are going to be talking about sexual assault. So this may not be appropriate for younger or some of our audience. What kind of sexual assault? Well, over the last decade, Chicago police have investigated more than 500 cases involving juveniles, all at Chicago public schools. This includes everything from obscene texts sent by a teacher to a student to a young track star who was raped multiple times by her coach. I'm describing crimes that are horrible on their own, but a recent Chicago Tribune investigation revealed that in many of these cases, the schools and CPS could have prevented them. I'm joined by two of the reporters from the Tribune's investigative team, David Jackson and Jennifer Smith Richards. David, welcome back. Jennifer, thanks for having you here as well to share your important work, both of you.
Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure.
David, there was a track star that you wrote about, as I just mentioned. Her story struck me, I'm sure as it did for many readers, just because it was incredibly awful to read those details, but also just because it seemed like a pretty big system failure. She was a 16-year-old, an honor student at Simeon Academy. Can you tell us about this case?
Yes, this happened in 2014, and it was a horrific story, a really tough one to write. A volunteer coach at Simeon had become, over the years, a established feature of the school. His name was Gerald Gaddy. He was known in the school as Coach Babyface. He started coaching in 2010. The school is supposed to do a mandated background check on all these volunteers and coaches. They didn't do it until the next year. And then when they started to do it, Gaddy disclosed that he had felony drug convictions that would have disqualified him and should have disqualified him from supervising students. The school sort of ignored all of that and went ahead, and Gaddy really was a good coach, I guess. The young people got stronger and faster under his supervision, and so they kept him at the school, and he became a feature of the school. We found that he had one primary victim, a 16-year-old track star, as you pointed out, who he basically lured into an arrangement in which he was raping her repeatedly. But he also sexually groped and molested and harassed many other students. We counted nine in total besides the primary victim. When the case came to light, it wasn't because somebody inside of Simeon brought it to light. It was an outsider who'd come to the school to help train young girls on reproductive health, and the girls confided to her what was happening. When she brought them to the principal's office, according to her account, the principal actually questioned the credibility of the first girl that she brought in. So it was a story of multiple failures, child protection failures on many layers.
We're speaking with Chicago Tribune investigative reporters David Jackson and Jennifer Smith Richards, both of them on the line from the Tribune newsroom, talking about their recent investigation stories out this week about these multiple, more than 100 cases, as we're talking about, particularly involving sexual abuse and assault within Chicago public schools. Jennifer, when you looked at all of the cases you collected data on, were there geographic patterns in terms of this happening in specific parts of the city or specific schools?
The only real pattern was that there was no pattern. These types of outcries from children and reports of abuse occurred all over the city, really in all areas of the city. It did not slow over time. There were some schools that had multiple reports and had multiple incidents of abuse and assault, but really no part of the city was spared.
And when we talk about the reporting of this, David, I wonder if we can get to some of that. And you alluded to this already in this particular case at Simeon, but in some of the cases that you wrote about, that wasn't the only instance of when a student would tell an adult that that it happened. Let's first just talk about the reporting before we get to the how people reacted. When students would actually tell adults something happened, sometimes it didn't even go through the proper channels. What is the procedure supposed to be within Chicago Public Schools when a student raises questions or comes with a story of abuse?
Good question. In Illinois, for years, even for decades, the law has been very, very clear, as it is in almost every state. If a student comes to any type of school worker with an outcry of sexual abuse, any worker, I'm talking a teacher, an administrator, a counselor, a lunchroom aide, all of those people are required by law to immediately call the state child welfare agency, DCFS, and make a report. Immediately. They're not allowed under the law to take that student and pass the student on to somebody else or ask somebody else to make a report. School workers are trained on this. They're given a very easy to understand kind of brochure outlining their responsibilities. And yet, time and time again, what we found as we delved into these cases was that instead of making that call, instead of doing what the law requires, school personnel would essentially do their own amateur sleuthing and try to figure out what was going on, try to play detective. They would interview the students sometimes multiple times and even interview other students and the perpetrators to try to get to the bottom of it. That had a horrible effect both on the individual victimized students and also on the subsequent law enforcement investigations.
And David, as you say then, I can't help but think our home station, Illinois Public Media, is based at the University of Illinois. So we have to undergo a lot of, as everyone who's on this campus has to undergo mandatory, all of those trainings you're talking about for sexual abuse and assault and reporting. And it seems like there are some basic things that you aren't supposed to do, which is, first of all, the sleuthing. Second of all, asking victims to repeat the story. Jennifer, there were students who did go through the proper reporting procedures, but then were subjected to not just intense interrogations, but also people who didn't believe them. Can you share some of those stories?
Sure. I think one case that comes to mind happened at Hubbard High School, where over a period of years, students and a former employee told us they had been going to top administrators and saying, there's a security guard here who is getting too close to students. He's touching them. He's saying sexually inappropriate things to them. And there's no record that any report to child welfare authorities was made. There were additional reports of abuse in 2014, the school did finally contact child welfare authorities and begin interviewing students. Now, they did the right thing in contacting, but at that time, they interviewed those students, as the students tell in court testimony, in groups, you know, several at a time. So those students are seeing one another and being interviewed in very close proximity to one another, which is, you know, again, something that child welfare experts warn against.
And when we think about this, and we think about in particular when after all of this, and David, I'm thinking about that case that we started with the beginning, the victim from Simeon Academy. That student actually sued the district for damages. That whole case ended up having a criminal case as well. What happened there?
Sure. The criminal case proceeded with Gaddy being convicted of raping that one young runner and also sexually molesting two other students. And he is currently serving a 40-year prison sentence. He declined to talk to us. The civil part was really interesting. I'm glad you brought that up. Essentially, in Chicago, in what many national experts call an obvious, blatant conflict of interest, the investigations of these cases are done by the city's law department, a special investigative unit within that department. They gather. They do actually a pretty good job in the cases we saw. They do a very thorough interviews and records gathering and so forth. But then the amazing thing we found is that after they're done with that, when the students like this one file civil lawsuits to hold the district accountable and seek justice for the suffering they endured, the same law department goes back to its investigative files and in the case of that young student, basically uses everything they'd gathered in the files to attack the student and try to undermine the student's case. And in the instance of the young woman who sued over the abuse she endured at Simeon, the district basically said in court papers that it was she who was responsible for the assaults on her and that she had consented, factually consented to these assaults, even though
as a 16-year-old.
Right. Yes, she was well below the age when a person in Illinois can legally consent to any type of sexual relationship.
That's David Jackson. We're also speaking with Chicago Tribune investigative reporter Jennifer Smith-Richards. Both of them are part of a team that the Tribune had on this story. We will tweet out a link for you to see more of this online. It's also at our website at 21stshow.org. Into this investigation to systemic juvenile sexual abuse in Chicago public schools. Jennifer, where does the State Board of Education fit into all of this? David mentioned the procedure of having an independent inspector general, which does not exist in Chicago. But what about at the state level?
Right. So at the school district level, they're really responsible for disciplining educators who they found to have committed some sort of misconduct. But when there's an educator in a district who has resigned amid investigation into sexual abuse or is fired, it's the district's duty to notify the state. And what the state is supposed to do is take a look at those referrals and sort of decide whether they need to revoke that educator's license so that they can't go and teach somewhere else or suspend it. And that's, you know, a very important role that the Illinois State Board of Education plays. What we found is that sometimes the state board does not take action at all. And in many cases, they took years after a school district reported a problem educator to take action against that person's license. And so that allows that educator to go on and work somewhere else with really, you know, no indication that they had some sort of prior issue in Chicago public schools.
Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel made his first public comments on this yesterday. Let's hear a little bit of what he had to say.
Look, I think all adults offer an apology. I offer my apology, but the question is, what are we going to do now besides words? What are the deeds to fix this up? I take responsibility, like Janice does take responsibility, to do this. My point is, if you have a suggestion for how to tighten something up, offer that.
Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel yesterday, that audio courtesy of the Chicago Tribune. David, what did you make of that response?
Well, I think that this has obviously become an issue right now that's at the moved for now into the center of the mayor's race, and Emanuel has really been forced by the other mayoral candidates to account for how he's running Chicago schools, not just in the wake of this scandal, but we've had other recent problems exposed by journalism. The school system has really failed to appropriately handle special education cases. They have also outsourced custodial work, and that has become a scandal as the as journalists in Chicago exposed the deplorable conditions in some schools. And Emmanuel has also really been on sort of continually under fire for his early decision in 2012 to undertake a massive reorganization and system of closure of schools.
And a historic number of schools being closed for that, too. Jennifer, what about the school district's response since your investigation ran? What are you hearing from CPS at this point?
We went with our findings to CPS in early May, and they responded even before publication that they were going to undertake some pretty significant changes. One is to conduct a top-to-bottom review of their practices and how they handle investigations for sexual abuse in the schools, what happens to educators after they have those findings. So they've hired an independent evaluator to come in and take that. But they've also decided they're going to institute some child protection measures that I think a lot of people would agree seem like pretty basic measures, including when a school employee is accused of sexual abuse of a child in the school, that employee is going to be removed immediately now, rather than to be left in the school while the investigation happens. And that's a pretty significant child protection measure.
Very disturbing reporting, very important reporting by the Chicago Tribune, this investigation into sexual assault in Chicago public schools. I want to thank Jennifer Smith-Richards and David Jackson, two of the multi-member Chicago Tribune team that did this investigation. Again, all of these stories, we will tweet out links to them, and they will be at our website. David, Jennifer, thank you for being with me. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on the 21st, we're going to be talking about a new reporting from the Illinois Newsroom about how schools across Illinois are dealing with students who experience trauma. Stay tuned. You're listening to the 21st in our All Schools Hour. Thanks for listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. All this hour, we're talking schools. Coming up, we're going to be hearing about a Belleville school that was the only one in Illinois to receive a national award for character. But right now, lots of children have traumatic experiences. And according to one CDC Kaiser Permanente study, the more traumatic experiences children suffer in early childhood, the more negative emotional and physical outcomes that happen later in life. Everything from depression to obesity to substance abuse. Lee Gaines has been reporting on how Illinois schools are stepping in to help these children. She reported on this for the Illinois Newsroom. That's a new statewide reporting project based here at Illinois Public Media, and she's with me now in our Urbana studios. Hi, Lee. Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
Also joining us on the line are two of the folks in Lee's story, Karen Sims, founder of Meridian K Consulting. She works with families, teachers, and kids to better cope with trauma. Christine Argue is also with us. She's an instructional resource and professional development director with the Illinois Education Association. She works with educators on this issue. In fact, Christine, are you at a school in Elgin right now for training?
Actually, I am. I'm at Elgin High School working with about 112 teachers, social workers, and school personnel on this very issue.
Well, thanks for being with us, Christine and Karen. Karen, let's start with you. I think as we've been hearing about, we hear about gun violence in the news as it relates to schools, especially in terms of mass shooting. But when we're talking about trauma and how it affects kids, are we mainly talking about violence, or is this something broader than that?
It's definitely something broader than that. So community violence is definitely a contributing factor. But we think about the whole range of traumatic experiences, and experiences affects and exposures is sort of the whole continuum. And so the story that you were just covering around sexual abuse could be one of those variables, family disruption from a lot of different reasons like child welfare involvement or parents being out of the home because of divorce or maybe incarceration could be a variable. Poverty and things like toxic stress are also variables. And just sort of being in an environment where students are more acutely aware of things like gun violence or terrorism that happens even globally or nationally makes students more acutely aware or has altered students' stress responses and makes them more vulnerable to things like to the signs and symptoms of trauma.
Christine, you mentioned to Lee that this is a public health crisis. Why is it important, do you think, to use those words specifically to describe what's happening here?
Well, I think it's important to use that terminology because when we talk about the traumatic stress indicators, like the ones that were just indicated, people have a tendency to think that, oh, not in my area, not in my neighborhood, not in my zip code, area code, et cetera. The truth of the matter is that everybody is impacted by adverse childhood experiences or toxic stress. I know that with the Kaiser Permanente study, there were 10 indicators, but those indicators were used just because that was what could be captured through the use of health insurance. If we were to ask about the difficulties that our students are facing, it would be far more than 10. So maybe you have a student population that doesn't fit into the 10 that are on the Kaiser Permanente study, but there are so many other adversities that our students are experiencing, and it is directly connected with the public. So I think using that terminology is important because it indicates that it isn't just about a subset group of people.
And Karen, can you explain a little bit more about why it's important to think about all of this also as trauma, as opposed to, I think there's a difference in a lot of people's heads between going through something rough and being traumatized?
Ooh, that's a great question. So what we know is when your ability to respond, survive, and deal with something overwhelms your coping strategy, it can alter how you think, feel, behave, and how your body functions. So trauma is simply sort of things being out of balance. So two people can experience the same situations, and it is traumatic when I remove sort of protective factors or resiliency factors, or where you're so young that the bad thing that happens overwhelms your ability to cope. So we look at, in some ways, the impact of change and the supports. And I will also add that the reason why we want it to be a public health approach is because that also implies that it's not just something, it's not a treatment that helps heal trauma. It's the things that we build in the community. It's the support. It's how we conceptualize it. And so a public health approach means that everyone is involved, everything from an individual family to the community at large, plays a role in helping both prevent trauma, but also helping people recover from traumatic experiences.
We're speaking with Karen Sims and Christine Argue. We're talking to both of them about the work they do with Illinois schools, helping families, teachers, and children better cope with trauma. We learned about them from reporting that Lee Gaines did. She's the education reporter for the Illinois Newsroom in studio with me here. Lee, so are we seeing more instances of children coming to school with, for example, behavior issues that can be traced back to trauma?
I would say yes, and that's from my discussions with Christine and Karen, and also from my experience at a trauma training that Karen hosted earlier this year. There were a lot of educators at this training, and a lot of what they had to say was they had children that they were working with. They had children, you know, as young as Head Start age all the way up to seniors in high school who were dealing with behavioral challenges, who were dealing with mental health challenges, and were also dealing with violence, being exposed to violence and also perpetrating violence.
And so how are schools coping with this, Lee?
So there's a growing understanding, I would say, across the country that this is impacting not only health outcomes, but this is also impacting academic outcomes. One thing that Karen said to me during the reporting process that's really stuck with me is that a child that's experiencing trauma does not have a chance to fulfill their academic potential or their career potential if that trauma isn't mitigated or addressed in some way, if those resiliency factors that she spoke about aren't being built up. And so schools, again, are recognizing this. Some places are further along than others. And in Illinois, I would say it's being done on kind of a piecemeal basis. And what I mean by that, it's being done by school to school, district to district. In Champaign, for example, they are working on trauma-informed training for all of the educators at Unit 4 schools. But there's no, I would say, like systemic statewide approach aside from what IEA is doing. So it is happening, but it's happening, you know, like I said, in this sort of bit-by-bit basis. And one of the important things that I learned from this project was one of the simplest things that schools can offer are supportive adult relationships for students that have experienced trauma. That can really, really help them overcome and build some of those coping strategies.
And Karen, when we think about that, are we equipping teachers to, you think, be these supportive adult relationships, whether they are as a teacher or in this case also, I think just being an adult who is in a relationship with kids and knows what they're going through because they're spending so much time with them?
So I think as Lee reported, we are doing it in a way that's in some ways a little bit haphazard, so not in a way that's systemic, but schools who want to improve culture and climate are rebuilding, remembering the importance of relationships. The other thing about the whole relationship model is every evidence-based practice, particularly evidence-based practices that are meant to address the needs of underserved students or students who are underperforming, talk about the importance of relationships. And now we know from biology and science and research that has come out of the trauma work, the why for it, because one of the things that we know about traumatized brains is it's hard for them to heal, to listen, to learn if they're not calm, and relationships help calm the brain. And teachers seem to get that, like, intuitively. So when you remind them about the why relationships matter, sometimes it's helping them reprioritize it. And now it's just about getting administrators and systems in place to support teachers needing to prioritize relationships. Because sometimes, right, there's structures in place where there's so many other obligations that really important thing doesn't get addressed in a way that's really meaningful.
And Christine, Lee mentioned IEA, the Illinois Education Association. What's involved in the kind of training that you're doing in schools? Is it different depending on the age level versus elementary versus, say, high school?
No, the approach is the same. I'll use District U46 is where we are today. So I'm in a room with 112 educators, and they range from pre-K all the way to high school. And basically what we're doing is, first of all, asking them to continue to be ambassadors and leaders with the learning. And what that means is that they will take the information that they are gathering today and yesterday and tomorrow, and they will figure out their spheres of influence, their portals of entry, where they can share the science with other people who need to know. So, you know, the information is the same regardless of whatever grade level you're in. So we talk about what adverse childhood experiences are. We talk about the impact of it and how that really does impact the brain. And we talk about executive function skills that are impacted and the social-emotional learning that needs to take place. And then we provide them with resources that they then determine what would be most useful for them in their workspaces. So, you know, it isn't something that is prescribed. I tell them right away, we don't have a notebook full of things that you must do. We don't have the magic switch that you turn on. It really is communicating that this is a paradigm shift. We're not looking to fix kids. They come how they are. We meet them where they are, and we understand that what we see in behavior very often is adaptive behavior because they're trying to survive. And we have to equip our educators with resources and skills and tools to help students to replace those adaptive behaviors that may not be as helpful in the school setting with those that will benefit them, not only in the school setting, but as community participants. And once they grow up as adults, just helping them to become productive citizens.
Christine, what kind of questions do you, I wonder what common questions you get in training from educators as you're in this, as you're describing this 3-day training that you're in right now with teachers at all levels? What are some of the common questions you get from teachers?
Well, so one very common question is, one of the main questions is, so what do we do? How do we fix it? Right? So that, I mean, that is like the question that permeates the air. And we always respond back to say it right now, it really is about raising the level of awareness so that administrators, legislators, those who have the capacity and the ability to make decisions to provide the kind of support that we need so that those things will happen. So a lot of our educators want to know, what do we do right now? How can we fix it tomorrow? And we don't have a simple answer for that. Another question that is often asked very early on, like with maybe the first 2.5 hours of the training, is there something that we will be able to do? In other words, they're looking for hope because they have been presented with students who are coming with far more difficulties than they've had to deal with in the past. So wanting to know if, in fact, there is something that they can do as educators to really help the students that are standing in front of them every day.
And Karen, what's your response to that? I imagine people have also posed that question to you, whether they are teachers or families who are looking for hope. What's your response to them?
So as Christine said, there are no simple answers. This is complex. However, I also advocate for whole brain responses. And so, you know, thinking from back to front, making sure that you first start off with relationships and making sure that students feel safe. So that's both a prevention and an intervention strategy. And then trying to make sure that students have a wide range of opportunities for learning so that use all senses that you think about creating a sensory-rich environment that supports learning. And that you sort of lower expectations, not lower expectations, but lower your investment in people engaging in what we talk about is executive functioning, so that we are more patient with some challenges around organization, and that you scaffold support, that you make sure that you're always seeing everything that you do from discipline to instruction to relationship building as being a learning strategy, and always thinking about what are you trying to do? What's the skill deficit? So if you see a student who's not engaging in a behavior that's helpful for them, that's maladaptive, then how are you scaffolding support so that they get the skills, supports, and resources and the opportunities to succeed and fail? So, you know, we advocate for things like restorative practices that are much more learning, you know, right? So if I have a discipline system that's based on restorative practices, that means I'm coming from a learning, helping relationship framework, which we know always leads to some better outcomes and helps students who've experienced lots of dysregulation, lots of distrustful relationships, acquire some of the skills they need to succeed.
We're almost out of time, but very quickly, Christine, I wonder, do you feel like this awareness is happening fast enough in the education community of trauma in children and schools?
I wish I could say that I thought it was happening fast enough, but it isn't. It isn't, simply. We're out there. We're doing the best that we can. We're trying to get people's attention, and that's why I think a public health approach is really important so that everybody becomes aware. But to answer your question, no, it's not happening quickly enough.
Well, I want to thank both of you for raising some awareness about this. Christine Argue, with the working with the Illinois Education Association. Karen Sims is the founder of Meridian K Consulting. Lee Gaines brought us a story. She's the education reporter for the Illinois Newsroom. And for those of you who are in the Champaign-Urbana area, we're actually inviting anyone actually who wants to come to the Illinois Newsroom next Tuesday. We're having a news and brews event to talk about this. Lee, can you explain what's going to happen next Tuesday?
And Nyla, you're going to host
it. And I'm hosting it.
So basically, it's a way to bring stories like this to life and continue the discussion, because as both Christine and Karen said, this is a complex topic that deserves further discussion.
We're going to be doing that next Tuesday at Riggs Brewery. If you're in the Champaign Urbana area, that's going to be at 6 o'clock in Urbana. All of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
We were really excited once we received this National School Character. Our class was like, yeah!
Character basically means what you are.
Yes.
Sometimes to me, what you are, what you say, what you do,
what you act like.
What you act like.
At my school, it taught me about character is that be yourself and don't try and be someone else, because if you do that, you'll probably lose a lot of people that you were your friends because you tried to be someone else.
Those are just some of the voices of students at Ellis Elementary School in Belleville, that audio courtesy of the Belleville News Democrat. As you heard, the students were talking about character, and they learned about it through being at Ellis Elementary every day and being part of a school that teaches character. Last month, the national organization character.org named 73 schools across the country as examples of character education done well. Ellis was the only school from Illinois on that list. Joining me now to talk about this is the principal of Ellis Elementary, Terry Kramer. Also with us is Nicole Deal, a school consultant with Character Plus based out of St. Louis. And Heather Kazad is the director of communications and community with character.org. All of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you.
Principal Kramer, let me start with you as the principal at Ellis Elementary. First of all, how would you describe the climate at your school?
Our climate is amazing. I will tell you, it's a very positive, well-developed climate from the minute that you walk into our building. Our values, in today's society, we know that our students face everyday challenges, and we want to give them the tools that they need to come into our school to be a productive citizen, and we realize that that's not just academics. Our academics will soar when we teach our students how to be upstanding citizens based on our character.
And why did you decide to do this? Why this focus on character? It makes sense that that's a little bit of an explanation, but when did you first start doing this?
So our initiative has come back, I would say, about 7 years ago when we realized that these students spend a majority of their time with us, and we wanted to start increasing our academic scores to have a decrease in discipline, and we realized that we could use character education to really change the climate in the building. And it has been a journey. Over the last 7 years, we've slowly integrated it within the curriculum, within our everyday philosophy, our morals. We've really reached out to the community. This isn't a student initiative. This is definitely a community initiative. The community has been extremely supportive, and it has lasting effects on our students. I can really say it has developed our school community into a very caring, positive culture.
That's Principal Terry Kramer from Ellis Elementary School in Belleville. Nicole Deal is also with us. She's with Character Plus in St. Louis. Nicole, when Principal Kramer says character education, what does that mean?
That phrase encompasses definitely a lot of ideas in people's minds, and there are a lot of terms that get thrown around, like social emotional learning and things like that. But we're really looking at, like Principal Kramer mentioned, building a good well-rounded student and citizen. And so there are lots of skills that are involved in that, and it does take a lot of effort to make that happen.
And Nicole, you actually run workshops for schools that are trying to implement this. What kind of things do you do in these workshops?
Correct. We work with educators to build, help them understand that students need to feel a sense of autonomy, belonging, and competence in school. And staff members need to feel that as well. And so we are looking at kind of laying those foundational pieces for how you build community within the classroom. So it's a place that everyone wants to be. And as Terry mentioned, and it then, you know, results in fewer discipline referrals and in academic scores improving as well.
And Heather Kazad's with us as well from character.org. Heather, what is it that you all do at character.org? What's the purpose of your organization?
So character.org is essentially a national leader and advocate for character development in communities across the country and also internationally. In addition to a national conference that we hold, resources that we have, membership models, we've named more than 500 national schools of character over the last 20 years, including Ellis. We work with state coordinators and people on the ground in the states, in the communities, to help them along their character journey.
And what are you looking at when you chose, for example, this year, 73 schools across the country?
Essentially, schools of character have to successfully implement the 11 principles of character education, which isn't a set curriculum, but it is a framework within which many curricula can fit into. That's how we can work with pre-K through 12 public, private, charter schools and districts. And the 11 principles essentially work to create a caring community with shared leadership among staff, students, and parents, and a meaningful and challenging curriculum within the school as well.
And so, Principal Kramer, you said this is something that you all have been doing for about 7 years. How did you first start implementing this and ingraining this into the culture of your school?
Well, we started... It's not always been an easy journey. Just like any journey, you have your ups and your downs. But once you have your teachers and your staff well-trained and the teachers know and they're willing to do the professional development because we want what's best for kids, we really kind of started laying the groundwork. Once the teachers and the staff were really involved, we were able to give that ownership over to the students. And then the community really bought in as well. The students truly have shared leadership with the adults. This is not an adult-run leadership program. The students really have a voice and a say into the opportunities that they get to contribute to the community.
And so what does it mean to say that the students have ownership? Can you give us an example in your elementary school?
I would love to. Mm-hmm. In our elementary school, one of the yearly projects we do is a building-wide theme. This year, the students voted on the theme for it to be sports, and they had a blast. And all of our service learning projects are voted on and are taken ownership by the students. So the students voted on doing a entire school-wide service learning project at the local Quarry League. Many of our students play baseball. They really have an interest. So we raised money. We took a bus out there. We cleaned up the Quarry League. We were able to get it prepped for the season. The students really just loved the opportunity to give back to their own community. The entire building, like I said, we raised money different ways. They were out selling popsicles. They were doing the soda can lids, but they took ownership in it. That is a building-wide theme, but they also have service learning projects that they come up with at each grade level. These are based on student interest as well. The students get to vote. They come up with the ideas. They have ways to fundraise. They make that connection within the curriculum. And then those change each year based on the students' interest.
And Principal Kramer, you said that sometimes this has been hard. What's been hard about implementing this?
I would say the hardest part is just to get kind of go away from your traditional thinking. We have these students for a majority of the day. There's more to education than just academics. We want to make sure when they leave Ellis that they are well-rounded, that they have both academics and character, and to really have the community, the students, the teachers understand that it takes a village. It's every single person working together to make a well-rounded citizen that we can put into our community.
And Nicole, to Principal Kramer's point, I wonder if oftentimes you run into concerns from schools or teachers wondering if they have the time or resources to implement something like this when the focus often is on academics and getting kids ready for tests and other things.
Absolutely. I would say that is probably the number one, you know, reason that people think that they don't have, that they don't, that they can't do this, is that they don't have time. And schools like Ellis and principals like Terry would probably tell you that when you give this the time it needs to get started, it really, in the end, results in giving you more time to get done what you need to do. And so we really say you don't have time not to do it, because you are creating a culture, whether you're intentional about that or not. And so being intentional about it and putting, you know, those core values into place that are really important for who your community is, in the long run, will really be beneficial for academics as well.
Principal Kramer, what have you heard from parents? What kind of feedback have you gotten from your parents of your own families of your students?
My parents love it. I have not had a negative parent who comes in to Ellis. So we believe in the open door policy to bring in the community. So families are here all the time. We do lots of surveys, so they're able to give their opinions as well and see some of the changes that they would like to see. You know, and even we had a kindergarten parent in here talking, and she's like, you know, it's crazy the amount of big words that my kindergartner uses. You know, he was struggling with his homework, and I asked him if I could help him. And he's like, no, Mom, I have perseverance. I'm going to do it. So I know that what we're doing has a great connection at home. So it's been very positive with our families.
And to Nicole's point about academics and tests, it's very easy to measure success with a test because you have a score and a grade. Are there ways you're measuring success with this, Principal Kramer? Is it by hearing these stories and feedback from families or from the community?
It is. It's stories, and you live it when you walk into our building. I mean, I can't explain the culture, but when you walk into our building, it just, you know that you're a part of a family. We have those relationships. It's a loving, caring feeling when you walk into our school. But we also, you know, we assess our character education program, you know, through our family connections, but we also send surveys traditionally, like to your staff, but we also do that to families and the students. So we have the students do a lot of reflection throughout the year, a lot of surveys, so that we can see and always have an understanding of our education program and where we need to tweak it. Once, you know, you receive national status, the journey's not over. It's still a continuous journey of, you know, implementing, changing. You have your student voices that change. Each set of kids are different. So we definitely have to keep the surveys to the students and have the students be able to reflect to us.
As you're talking about this, I can't help but think of most of the conversations I have with principals and school superintendents over the past 2 years. It's been about school funding and how stressful it is to be in a school in Illinois. Do you find that programs like this help improve morale or just how everybody's feeling about coming to work every day when they're in a school?
Absolutely. Our character program is, like I said, it's not just for the students, it's for the staff. And we have so many things in place for the morale of our teachers and for our staff that you do. You come to work and we have a really good time educating the kids. That's what we love. It's what we want to do. And having a character program, I would say, benefits many of the teachers on a subject we really didn't talk about, and that's discipline. When your discipline in your classroom goes down dramatically, you're able to teach to the academics. You're able to have those conversations about your assessments. And that's what's happened for us, is when we looked into you really using a character education program, you know, and you include your restorative practices, your discipline decreases. You have built those relationships. That is a must. Building relationships in our building is a very high priority with everyone, the students, each other, our staff. Everybody is an equal when you walk into our building.
Principal Kramer, we have less than a minute left, but I just want to ask you quickly if you have advice for anyone thinking about doing this in their own school.
Yes, absolutely. There is no reason I would ever tell you no. Even preparing and applying, the amount of professional development that you receive is amazing. It's a journey that character.org will help you with. You will see an increase in academic scores, a decrease in, you know, your discipline. It's truly an amazing program, and I would highly recommend it.
I want to thank Principal Kramer with Ellis Elementary School in Belleville, Nicole Deal with Character Plus, and Heather Kazad with Character.org for being with me. Ladies, thanks for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We're out of time for today. Tomorrow we're going to be hearing about a new book out from Illinois State University History Professor Roger Biles about the life of the first and only Black mayor of Chicago, Harold Washington. He's going to be joining us from Bloomington. By the way, do you have the NPR One app? You can download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps, and you can always find past shows there. It's pretty simple to download and set your home station. We are a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a good day.